Thank you. Those of you who are standing may be seated. And good morning to everyone. We're going to start the morning by introducing ourselves. This is a WebEx argument, so I'm Mike Havigan, the Chief Justice, and by seniority on the court, we will go to Justice Miller Lerman.
Good morning, Justice Miller Lerman, appearing by WebEx. Thank you.
William Castle, good morning.
Stephanie Stacy, good morning.
Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Pavick.
John Frydenberg.
Mr. Bartling and Ms. Duffy, good morning to you. I won't go through the mask and distancing details that I would go through if we were having this argument in court. But before we begin, this is the first case of the day, State versus Madron. Do either of you have any questions?
No, sir.
Thank you very much then, Mr. Bartling. Good morning to you. You may proceed.
Thank you, Judge. May I ask Ms. Stewart to reserve 1.5 minutes for rebuttal, please? Thank you. May it please the court, counsel for the state, appellant James Madron thanks the Supreme Court for sustaining his petition for further review and providing him with the opportunity to be heard further with respect to the issues he presents to this court. The primary issue that Mr. Madron presents to this court centers on the improper presence of a non-juror during the deliberation phase of Mr. Madron's jury trial. The record of the proceeding from the District Court for Douglas County demonstrates that there were 13 individuals, a 12-person jury, and a non-juror, that is the alternative juror, who conducted deliberations and shared communications after the final submission of the cause to the jury by the court.
Is there anything in the record that shows improper communication by the alternate juror?
Yes, Judge. Judge Gleason, who had the proceeding in acknowledging his error, indicated that he believed that the jurors were unaware of them, of the 13 persons in the jury room, because they were deliberating so seriously. And you'll find that on the Bill of Exceptions, page 484, lines 12 through 23. The judge states, and I'm quoting, clearly the 13 of you didn't recognize that you still had the alternate. That shows me you were taking the matter seriously and you were working on the matter rather than the number of people. It's also clear.
What did Judge Gleason base that upon? Was that conjecture or was there actually some evidence taken?
There was no evidence taken regarding this issue at the trial stage. Judge Gleason's comments appear to be an inference he made, having first convened the attorneys when the matter came to his attention, and then bringing the jury into the room, making the statement that he made, along with other statements about their deliberations and their communication.
Counsel, whose responsibility is it to adduce evidence as to the role of the alternate juror, whether they added to the conversation? Whose responsibility is it to feather that out?
It's the state's responsibility when the issue comes before the court. And the reason it's the state's responsibility is because this court has held that in the context of a criminal case, if communication occurs between a jury and a non-juror, there is a rebuttable presumption of prejudice, and that rebuttable presumption of prejudice is only overcome when the state, who bears the burden to demonstrate that it didn't exist. In other words, the rule or test presumes that when there is communication, the communication is improper, and then the rule or test creates an avenue to dispel any such improper communication and places the duty to do so on the state.
Don't we have to speculate in this case to find that there was any communication at all by the alternate juror?
I do not believe we need to speculate, Judge. There is suggestions in the record because there was no evidentiary hearing. Recall, defense counsel, when this matter came before the court, prior to Judge Gleason bringing the 13 individuals back in the courtroom and discharging the alternate juror, defense counsel asked the court to make an inquiry pursuant to statute as to any role that the alternate juror had in the communications or deliberations. Judge Gleason declined that request, stating that he believed if he did that, he would create an issue, and he did not want to create an issue. And you will find that reference in the Bill of Exceptions at page 483, line 25 through 484.3, where Judge Gleason specifically states, if I were to inquire of Ms. Wilson, who is the alternate, in the presence of the jury, then I am just creating an issue.
Was any evidence presented at the time of the motion for a new trial, which was approximately, I believe, 2 months later, with regard to communications that occurred during the deliberations?
No, short answer is no, Judge. There was a request by trial counsel prior to a continued sentencing hearing, at which time trial counsel sought leave to continue the sentencing to obtain affidavits from the 13 participants in the deliberations. Judge Gleason declined that request. But I would suggest to the court that the fact that defense counsel didn't adduce evidence on an issue where the state bears the burden or has the duty to do so is not inherent error on defense counsel.
Why is it insufficient? Judge Gleason did inquire of the jury, correct, asking if they relied upon anything that said. Why is their non-response to that insufficient to rebut any presumption?
Well, number one, it's a generous interpretation to call what Judge Gleason did an inquiry of the jury. He made that statement to the jurors or postulated that question to the jurors only after the jury had discussed the case with a 13th person, reached a verdict, and issued the verdict. And Judge Gleason's question was,
but also after the alternate was sent away and told them to start from scratch.
Correct. And in the brief of appellant, we referred to that concept as a legal do-over or a mulligan. And that's just simply not the procedure. The statute lays out a procedure to follow. The case law lays out a procedure to follow. And in effect, Judge Gleason's comment of not wanting to create an issue was tantamount to saying, I am not going to follow the case law procedure. I'm not going to follow the statutory procedure because the trial has come to an end, and I do not want to disrupt a potential verdict. Those words are not in the Bill of Exceptions. I concede that. But that is, in effect, what happened in this case. The reason we're here on petition for further review, among others, is because in evaluating this case, the Court of Appeals took the approach that what Judge Gleason did was, in effect, satisfaction of the case law and satisfaction of the statute. And the way the Court of Appeals reached that conclusion is by conducting a harmless error analysis that they derived from State versus Winnie, which is 239 Nebraska 513. Very clearly, in our petition for further review, we lay out the factual and legal distinctions between Winnie and Mr. Madron's case. But at a general or global level, the principal distinction is that in the Winnie case, the trial court took evidence in the form of having the alternative juror testify, having 10 other jurors testify and receiving a stipulation between defense counsel and the state as to what the testimony of the remaining jurors would be. Conversely, as this court knows, in Madryn's case, not only was there no testimony or no offer of testimony, the request for such an inquiry by defense counsel was denied by the court. And because I'm in my rebuttal time, I will make the final statement at this point. In effect, what the Court of Appeals did when they evaluated Madryn's case was they conflated the district court's interaction with the jurors and questions such as, did any of you have any influence, to which the court received no answer, with the state's duty to rebut the presumption of prejudice that arises in this context. It's Mr. Madryn's position that that is improper. It's a violation of the Sixth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 6 and 11 of the Nebraska Constitution. And it was such a significant error that it warrants the return of this case for a new trial. Thank you.
I really want to save a little time, so I'm going to ask this question very quickly. That is it your position that any time that this situation would happen where the alternate is accidentally not discharged, mistrial is necessary?
Well, that's the short answer to that is no. The case law does not compel a mistrial in every situation where there is some communication between the non-juror and the jury. However, the procedure that's put into effect is one of inquiry to determine what the nature of that communication was. And the basic premise is the nature of that communication is improper. So the inquiry is to determine whether there has been some influence of any kind that has impeded on the jury's ability to reach a verdict based on the evidence. And those are the underlying principles that we try to preserve by having a jury and only the jury deliberate as to a criminal defendant's guilt or non-guilt.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Duffy, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel for the appellant, I'm Siobhan Duffy, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appellee, the State of Nebraska. The Court of Appeals affirmed appellant's sentence and convictions, and this court granted appellant's petition for further review. And in that petition, appellant took issue with the Court of Appeals' reasoning he was not prejudiced by the presence of the alternate juror in the jury room for approximately an hour of deliberations. The state believes the court correctly ruled that the district court did not err in denying appellant's motion for mistrial and his motion for new trial on this basis, and we ask you to affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals. The alternate was in the jury room for approximately an hour before the district court realized it neglected to dismiss her. The district court called the jury back.
Did the state have the burden to show that no prejudice occurred in this matter? If not, why not?
Your Honor, I really struggled with the issue of how to frame what occurred because it doesn't really feel like jury misconduct because the alternate was still a member of the jury. She had not been dismissed when the jury was sent back. And so the jury was following their instructions. And so I struggle with calling this communication between a juror and a non-juror because at the time the alternate was still a member of the jury. But the state recognizes that, you know, this court has stated that 12 is the magic number and there were 13 people in that room. So I think whether this court chooses to analyze this as appellant has shown that there was communication between a juror and a non-juror and thus prejudice is presumed, but it's a rebuttable presumption of prejudice. And then in that case, the state has the burden to prove that no prejudice occurred. But I still think, I don't think that the fact that the district court was the person who asked the question of the jury, whether they considered the participation of the alternate, I don't think that that is relevant to whether it has been shown that no prejudice occurred. I think that it was fine for the district court to be the one to make the inquiry. And I don't think that we shouldn't consider what came out of that inquiry simply because the district court asked the question rather than the prosecutor. I think the ultimate question is, was the presumption of prejudice rebutted? And if we're under the framework of we presume prejudice, And in that case, the answer is yes, because when the district court realized it neglected to dismiss the alternate, it called the jury back, informed the alternate of her status, dismissed her, and instructed the jury to begin deliberations from scratch as if they started then. And the district court asked the jury if that made sense. The jury responded affirmatively. And then after the jury returned its verdict, the district court said it was going to make an additional inquiry. It again noted for the jury what had occurred, reminded them that they had been instructed to start deliberations anew, and stated that if any member of the jury in reaching the verdict had considered participation or conversations from the alternate, they needed to come and let the district court know. And no member of the jury stated that they had, in fact, considered participation from the alternate. So the state believes that that was sufficient to show that the jury began their deliberations from the beginning without the presence of the alternate, and that the Court of Appeals was correct in concluding that the record showed that the jury was not affected, the deliberations were not affected by the presence of the alternate for an hour, and that no prejudice occurred to appellant.
If we were to, I beg your pardon, if we were to assume that at the close of the trial, the 13th person became, by operation of law, a non-juror, how would that affect your analysis? And if that's the case, that the 13th person became a non-juror, is the remedy that the trial court used, start from scratch, adequate? And is there case law that says that's an adequate remedy as opposed to a mistrial or et cetera?
Well,
that was three questions in one, and I beg your pardon.
I'm ready. So I think it would affect the analysis. If we assume that the juror, the 13th person, became just as a non-juror because we know that they're the alternate, then yes, then the then there would have been some communication between a non-juror and the jury. And so that, pursuant to this court's case law, once that's been shown by preponderance of the evidence, it then there's we presume that prejudice occurred and the burden's on the state to prove that no prejudice resulted. So I believe that was the first question. The second question is, I may have missed some of them, but I believe, was the district court's remedy adequate? And I think that it was. I think juries are often instructed either disregard a certain piece of evidence or only consider this evidence for a certain purpose, but not another that you might want to consider it for. And so I think the district court instructing the jury, start over, start from the beginning without the presence of the alternates. I think that that was important. That was sufficient, especially when combined with the second inquiry the district court made. I think that this is a very fact-specific case. And I think that second inquiry that the district court made, where it, after instructing the jury to start again, it confirmed the jury understood. And then after the jury rendered its verdict, it confirmed the jury had followed that instruction. I think that was very important in showing, we presume juries follow their instructions, and absent evidence to the contrary, that's what we presume. And here, we don't just have a lack of evidence to the contrary, we actually have evidence showing the district court was asked if they followed their instructions.
Counsel, should the district judge, at the time the discovery was made and the alternate was discharged, have individually interviewed the remaining jurors to ask the question, can you disregard anything that was said by the alternate during the beginning deliberations?
Your Honor, I think had the district court done that, I don't think it would have been inappropriate, but I don't think that it was required. I think that when the district court gave the jury the instruction to start again and then confirm with the jury that they understood, I think perhaps if there had been a jury member who said, well, I can't do that, alternate jurors spoke at length about this. I think the jury had the opportunity at that point to say whether they felt they did not understand the instruction or they couldn't follow it. And then I think that second inquiry the district court made is very key, because the jury...
I'm concerned about that second inquiry. If you've ever been in a courtroom when the jury comes back and the judge asks some quick questions, Is this the verdict of everybody on the jury and so forth? It is hardly the kind of setting, I think, that is adequate or appropriate for taking any serious evidence. How do you respond to my concerns?
Well, Your Honor, I think my response, if we kind of compare this to when juries are being selected, which is also a very serious process, oftentimes jurors are asked very important, serious questions that some of them may feel uncomfortable answering in front of a group of people. And typically jurors in that case would ask to speak privately with the court or counsel. So I don't think anything would have prohibited a juror from doing that. But following...
It seems to be placing a lot of burden on the jury in this case and not on the state. How do you respond to that?
Your Honor, I think juries have a burden placed on them. I don't know that it's any greater of a burden placed on the jury than deciding someone's guilt or innocence. And I understand your concern that perhaps after a few day trial and then sitting through deliberations. But I also think that's where appellant had the opportunity in his motion for new trial to be able to, if one of the jurors had actually felt, gosh, you know, looking back, I think that I did, or I felt uncomfortable, appellant could have tried to make that allegation. But I think that the evidence, the record at trial, after the inquiry from the judge both times showed that the jury was instructed to start again and that the jury followed that instruction. And thus the Court of Appeals was correct in concluding that the presence of the alternate did not affect jury deliberations and no prejudice occurred to appellant. With that, I see that I am close to being out of time. In the 40 seconds remaining, I am happy to answer any questions. Otherwise, we would request this court affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals, which affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Bartling, I'm going to give you a minute for a rebuttal because we have to request at the end of the time period.
Thank you, Judge. In 1 minute, let me summarize the case as follows. 13 individuals went to judge James Madron's guilt or non-guilt. That problem was brought to the court's attention by defense counsel. On page 483, line 10 of the Bill of Exceptions, that defense counsel requested an inquiry. The court declined to do that inquiry, stating that the court didn't want to create an issue. The court's duty at that point was to explore an issue because the case law suggested there was presumptive prejudice. The burden then shifted to the state to make an inquiry, but the state asked that the judge simply reread instruction 16. Instruction 16 did not cure this defect. By operation of law 29-2004-2, the non-juror became a non-juror at the time the case was submitted, which it was, and this court needs to reverse the Court of Appeals because the district court can't operate as the state to conduct this inquiry when the Supreme Court has said repeatedly that it is the state's burden to address any presumption of prejudice that arises in this context. Thank you.
Mr. Bartling, are you conceding that an alternate juror has the same status in law as a member of the selected jury prior to the submission of the case?
No, Judge. And in fact, in the original brief of appellant in this case, on pages 16 and 17, there is an analysis drawing a legal distinction between a juror and an alternate juror that is based on and cited from the Nebraska revised statutes.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you both very much. We greatly appreciate that. This concludes arguments for State versus Madden.